Welcome to the Book Hour, which is a production of Sight into Sound Radio. Hello, welcome to the 15th reading of All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Dewar. I'm Jim Abate. Before we begin, let me explain again that the book is read in its entirety and that some of the reading may contain explicit descriptions that some people could find objectionable. If you did not hear the last reading of this book, let me bring you up to date. In our last reading, while the invasion of Normandy took place, the Austrians installed an 88mm cannon onto a bastion at the Hotel of Bees. Werner knows that the Frenchman's antenna must be on a tall chimney in St. Malo and goes out on his own and sees the antenna. Claude Lavic told Rumpel where LeBlanc lived, number 4, Rue Vaubray. Werner, dreaming of meeting the man he heard as a child, saw Marie-Laure and followed her to the bakery and thought of her as being very pure. Von Rumpel followed Marie-Laure to the grotto. When he slipped, she locked the gate while still in the grotto. When Marie-Laure did not return in a reasonable time, Etienne went to the bakery and Madame Rouet suggested they go to the grotto. Von Rumpel wanted to know if Monsieur LeBlanc left anything with her when he left. She told him only the model of the city and a broken promise. After he left, Etienne and Madame Rouet found her and brought her home. Etienne decided Marie-Laure should not leave home again. Newman 1 and 2 are both sent to fight in the war. Marie-Laure found the stone in the model of Etienne's house and put the model of the house in her pocket. Etienne went out to find the placements of the German guns to broadcast it, but he did not return. No one may now leave St. Malo by the order of the Germans. On August 12, 1944, Werner told Volkheimer, while entombed in the Hotel of Bees, that he had found the transmitter, and it was only an old man and a girl. As we now continue with All the Light We Cannot See. Fort National. Etienne begged his jailers, the guardian of the fort, dozens of his fellow prisoners. "My niece, my great niece, she's blind, she's alone." He told them he was 63, not 60, as they claimed, that his papers had been unfairly confiscated, that he was not a terrorist. He wobbled before the Feldwebel in charge and stumbled through the few German phrases he could stitch together. "Sie müssen mich helfen. My nicht ist hierin dort." But the Feldwebel shrugged like everybody else and looked back at the city burning across the water as if to say, "What can anyone do in the face of that?" Then the stray American shell struck the fort, and the wounded howled down in the munitions cellar, and the dead were buried under rocks just above the tide line, and Etienne stopped talking. The tide slips away, then climbs back up. Whatever energy Etienne has left goes into quieting the noise in his head. Sometimes he almost convinces himself that he can see through the smoldering skeletons of the seafront mansions at the northwestern corner of the city to the rooftop of his house. He almost convinces himself it stands, but then it disappears again behind a mantle of smoke. No pillow, no blanket. The latrine is apocalyptic. Food comes irregularly, carried out from the citadel by the guardian's wife across the quarter mile of rocks at low tide, while shells explode in the city behind her. There's never enough. Etienne diverts himself with fantasies of escape. Slip over a wall. Swim several hundred meters. Drag himself through the shore break. Scamper across the mined beach with no cover to one of the locked gates. Absurd. Out here, the prisoners see the shells smash into the city before they hear them. During the last war, Etienne knew artillerymen who could peer through field glasses and discern their shells' damage by the colors thrown skyward. Gray was stone, brown was soil, pink was flesh. He shuts his eyes. He remembers lamp-lit hours in Monsieur Ebrard's bookshop, listening to the first radio he ever heard. He remembers climbing into the choir of the cathedral to listen to Henri's voice as it rose toward the ceiling. He remembers the cramped restaurants with lettered windows and linen fold paneling where his parents took them to dinner, and the Corsairs' villas with scallop friezes and Doric columns and gold coins mortared inside the walls, the storefronts of gunsmiths and shipmasters and money changers and hostlers, the graffiti Henri used to scratch into the stones of ramparts. "I cannot wait to leave. Fuck this place." He remembers the LeBlanc house, his house, tall and narrow with the staircase spiraling up its center like a spire shell stood on end, where the ghost of his brother occasionally slipped between walls, where Madame Manette lived and died, where not so long ago he could sit on a davenport with Marie-Laure and pretend they flew over the volcanoes of Hawaii, over the cloud forests of Peru, where just a week ago she sat cross-legged on the floor and read to him about a pearl fishery off the coast of Ceylon, Captain Nemo and Orono in their diving suits, the impulsive Canadian Ned Land about to hurl his harpoon through the sides of a shark. All of it is burning, every memory he ever made. Above Fort National, the dawn becomes deeply, murderously clear, the Milky Way a fading river. He looks across to the fires. He thinks the universe is full of fuel. Captain Nemo's last words. By noon on the 12th of August, Marie-Laure has read 7 of the last 9 chapters into the microphone. Captain Nemo has freed his ship from the giant squid only to stare into the eye of a hurricane. Pages later, he rammed a warship full of men passing through its hull. Vern writes like a sailmaker's needle through cloth. Now the captain plays a mournful, chilling dirge on his organ as the Nautilus sleeps in the wastelands of the sea. 3 pages are left. If Marie-Laure has brought anyone comfort by broadcasting the story, if her great-uncle crouched in some dank cellar with 100 men tuned her in, if some trio of Americans reclined in the nighttime fields as they cleaned their weapons and traveled the dark gangways of the Nautilus with her, she cannot say. But she is glad to be so near the end. Downstairs, the German has shouted twice in frustration, then fallen silent. Why not, she considers, just slide through the wardrobe and hand the little house to him and find out if he will spare her. First she will finish, then she'll decide. Again she opens the model house and tips the stone into her palm. What would happen if the goddess took away the curse? Would the fires go out? Would the earth heal over? Would doves return to the windowsills? Would Papa come back? Fill your lungs, beat your heart. She keeps the knife beside her, fingertips pressed to the lines of the novel. The Canadian harpooner Ned Land has found his window for escape. "The sea's bad," he says to Professor Arnax, "and the wind's blowing strong." "I'm with you, Ned. But let me tell you that if we're caught, I'm going to defend myself, even if I die doing it." "We'll die together, Ned, my friend." Marie-Laure turns on the transmitter. She thinks of the whelks in Arrow Bazin's kennel, then thousands of them, how they cling, how they draw themselves up into the spirals of their shells, how, when they're tucked into that grotto, the gulls cannot come in to carry them up into the sky and drop them on the rocks to break them. Visitor. Von Rumpel drinks from a bottle of skunked wine he has found in the kitchen. 4 days in this house, and how many mistakes has he made? The sea of flames could have been in the Paris Museum all along, that simpering mineralogist and the assistant director laughing as he slunk away, duped, fooled, inveigled. Or the perfumer could have betrayed him, taking the diamond from the girl after marching her away. Or Levite might have walked her right out of the city while she carried it in her ratty knapsack. Or the old man could have jammed it up his rectum and is just now shitting it out, 20 million francs in a pile of feces. Or maybe the stone was never real at all. Maybe it was all hoax, all story. He had been so certain he had found the hiding spot, solved the puzzle, certain the stone would save him. The girl didn't know. The old man was out of the picture. everything was set up perfectly. What is certain now? Only the murderous bloom inside his body, only the corruption it brings to every cell. In his ears come the voice of his father. You are only being tested. Someone calls to him in German. Istaver! Father? You in there? Von Rumpel listens, sounds drawing nearer through the smoke. He crawls to the window, sets his helmet on his head, thrusts his head over the shattered sill. A German infantry corporal squints up from the street.
Sir, I didn't expect. Is the house clear, sir?
Empty, yes. Where are you headed, corporal?
The fortress at La Cité, sir. We are evacuating, leaving everything. We still hold the chateau and the bastion à la Hollande. All other personnel are to fall back.
Von Rumpel braces his chin on the sill, feeling as if his head might separate from his neck and go tumbling down to explode on the street.
The entire town will be inside the bomb line, the corporal says.
How long?
There will be a ceasefire tomorrow, noon, they say, to get civilians out. Then they resume the assault.
Von Rumpel says,
"We're giving up the city?"
A shell detonates not far away, and the echoes of the blast shunt down between the wrecked houses, and the soldier in the street claps a hand over his helmet. Bits of stone skitter across the cobbles. He calls,
"You are with which unit, Sergeant Major?"
"Continue with your work, Corporal. I'm nearly done here."
Final sentence. Volkheimer does not stir. The liquid at the bottom of the paint bucket, however toxic it was, is gone. Werner has heard nothing from the girl on any frequency for how long? An hour? More? She read about the Nautilus getting sucked down into a whirlpool, waves higher than houses, the submarine standing on end, its steel ribs cracking, and then she read what he assumed was the last line of the book. Thus, to that question asked 6,000 years ago by Ecclesiastes, that which is far off and exceeding deep, who can find it out? Only two men now have the right to answer, Captain Nemo and myself. Then the transmitter snapped off, and the absolute darkness closed around him. For these past days, how many, it has felt as though the hunger were a hand inside him, thrusting around in the cavity of his chest, reaching up to his shoulder blades, then down to his pelvis, scraping at his bones. Today, though, or is it tonight, the hunger peters out like a flame for which no fuel remains. Emptiness and fullness, in the end, somehow the same. Werner blinks up to see the Viennese girl in her cape descend through the ceiling as if it is no more than a shadow. She carries a paper sack full of withered greens and seats herself amid the rubble. Around her swirls a cloud of bees. He can see nothing, but he can see her. She counts on her fingers. "For tripping in line," she says, "for working too slowly, for arguing over bread, for loitering too long in the camp toilet, for sobbing, for not organizing her things according to protocol." It's surely nonsense, yet something hangs inside it, some truth he does not want to allow himself to apprehend. And as she speaks, she ages. Silver hair lays down on her head, her collar frays. She becomes an old woman, his understanding of who hovers at the rim of his consciousness. "For complaining of headaches, for singing, for speaking at night in her bunk, for forgetting her birth date during evening muster, for unloading the shipment too slowly, for not turning in her keys correctly, for failing to inform the guard, for rising from bed too late." Frau Schwarzenberger, that's who she is, the Jewess in Friedrich's elevator. She runs out of fingers as she counts. "For closing her eyes while being addressed, for hoarding crusts, for attempting to enter the park, for having inflamed hands, for asking for a cigarette, for a failure of imagination." And in the darkness, it feels as if Werner has reached bottom, as if he has been whirling deeper all this time, like the Nautilus sucked under the maelstrom,
like his father, descending into the pits, a one-way dive from Zovarain past Sopforta, past the horrors of Russia and Ukraine, past the mother and daughter in Vienna, his ambition and shame becoming one and the same, to the nadir in his basement on the rim of the continent where the apparition chants nonsense. Frau Schwarzenberger walks toward him, transforming herself as she approaches from woman to girl. Her hair becomes red again. Her skin smooths. A seven-year-old girl presses her face up against his, and in the center of her forehead, he can see a hole blacker than the blackness around him, at the bottom of which teems a dark city full of souls. 10,000. 500,000. All these faces staring up from alleys, from windows, from smoldering parks, and he hears thunder. Lightning. Artillery. The girl evaporates. The ground quakes. The organs inside his body shake. The beams groan, then the slow trickle of dust and the shallow, defeated breaths of Volkheimer a meter away. Music number one. Sometime after midnight on August 13, after surviving in her great-uncle's attic for 5 days, Marie-Laure holds a record with her left hand while she turns the fingers of her right gently through the grooves, reconstructing the whole song in her head. Each rise and fall, then she slots the record on the spindle of Etienne's electrophone. No water for a day and a half, no food for two. The attic smells of heat and dust and confinement and her own urine in the shaving bowl in the corner. "We'll die together, Ned, my friend." The siege, it seems, will never end. Masonry crashes into the streets. The city falls to pieces. Still, this one house does not fall. She takes the unopened can out of her great-uncle's coat pocket and sets it in the center of the attic floor. For so long she has saved it, maybe because it offers some last tie to Madame Manek, maybe because if she opens it and finds it spoiled, the loss will kill her. She places the can and brick beneath the piano bench, where she knows she can find them again. Then she double-checks the record on the spindle, lowers the arm, places the needle at the outside edge, finds the microphone switch with her left hand, the transmitter switch with her right. She is going to turn it up as loud as it will go. If the German is in the house, he will hear. He'll hear piano music draining down through the upper stories and cock his head, and then he'll rove the sixth floor like a slavering demon. Eventually, he'll set his ear to the doors of the wardrobe, where it will be louder still. What mazes there are in this world, the branches of trees, the filigree of roots, the matrix of crystals, the streets her father recreated in his models, mazes in the nodules on murex shells, and in the texture of sycamore bark and inside the hollow of bones of eagles. None more complicated than the human brain, Etienne would say, what may be the most complex object in existence, one wet kilogram within which spin universes. She places the microphone into the bell-shaped speaker of the electrophone, switches on the record player, and the plate begins to spin. The attic crackles. In her mind, she walks a path in the Jardin des Plantes, the air golden, the wind green, the long fingers of willows drifting across her shoulders. Ahead is her father. He extends a hand, waiting. The piano starts to play. Marie-Laure reaches beneath the bench and locates the knife. She crawls along the floor to the top of the seven-rung ladder and sits with her feet dangling and the diamond inside the house in her pocket and the knife in her fist. She says, "Come and get me." Music number two. Beneath the stars over the city, everything sleeps. Gunners sleep. Nuns in a crypt beneath the cathedral sleep. Children in old Corsair cellars sleep in the laps of sleeping mothers. The doctor in the basement of the Hotel Dieu sleeps. Wounded Germans in the tunnels below the Fort of La Cité sleep. Behind the walls of Fort National, Etienne sleeps. Everything sleeps, save the snails climbing the rocks and the rats scurrying among the piles. In a hole beneath the ruins of the Hotel of Bees, Werner sleeps too. Only Volkheimer is awake. He sits with the big radio in his lap where Werner has set it, and the dying battery between his feet and static whispering in both ears, not because he believes he will hear anything, but because this is where Werner has left the headphones, because he does not have the will to push them off, because he convinced himself hours ago that the plaster heads on the other side of the cellar will kill him if he moves. Impossibly, the static coalesces into music. Volkheimer's eyes open as wide as they can, straining the blackness for every stray photon. A single piano runs up scales, then back down. He listens to the notes and the silences between them, and then finds himself leading horses through a forest at dawn, trudging through snow behind his great-grandfather, who walks with a saw draped over his huge shoulders and the snow squeaking beneath boots and hooves, all the trees above them whispering and creaking. They reach the edge of a frozen pond, where a pine grows as tall as a cathedral. His great-grandfather goes to his knees like a penitent, fits the saw into a groove in the bark, and begins to cut. Volkheimer stands, finds Werner's leg in the darkness, puts the headphones on Werner's ears. "Listen," he says, "listen, listen." Werner comes awake. Chords float past in transparent riffles. "Clair de Lune." Claire, a girl so clear you can see right through her. Volkheimer says, "Hook the light into the battery." "Why?" "Do it." Even before the song has stopped playing, Werner disconnects the radio from the battery, unscrews the bezel and bulb from the dead field light, touches it to the leads, and gives them a sphere of light. At the back corner of the cellar, Volkheimer drags blocks of masonry and pieces of timber and shattered section of wall out of the rubble, stopping now and then only to lean over his knees and catch his breath. He stacks them into a barrier. Then he pulls Werner behind this makeshift bunker, unscrews the base of a grenade, and yanks the pull cord to ignite the 5-second fuse. Werner sets one hand over his helmet, and Volkheimer throws the grenade at the place where the stairwell used to be. Music, number 3. Von Rumpel's daughters were fat, roiling little babies, weren't they? Both of them always dropping their rattles or rubber pacifiers and tangling themselves in blankets. Why so tortured, little angels? But they grew, despite all his absences, and they could sing, especially Veronica. Maybe they weren't going to be famous, but they could sing well enough to please a father. They'd wear their big felt boots and those awful shapeless dresses their mother made for them, primroses and daisies embroidered along the collars, and fold their hands behind their backs and belt out lyrics they were too young to understand. "Men cluster to me and moths around a flame, and if their wings burn, I know I'm not to blame." In what might be a memory or a dream, Von Rumpel watches Veronica, the early riser, kneel on the floor of Marie Laura's room in the pre-dawn darkness and march a doll in a white gown alongside another in a gray suit down the streets of the modeled city. They turn left, then right, until they reach the steps of the cathedral, where a third doll waits, dressed in black, one arm raised, wedding or sacrifice, he cannot say. Then Veronica sings so softly that he cannot hear the words, only the melody, less like the sounds made by a human voice and more like the notes made by a piano, and the dolls dance, swaying from foot to foot. The music stops, and Veronica vanishes. He sits up. The model at the foot of the bed bleeds away and is a long time restoring itself. Somewhere above him, the voice of a young man starts speaking in French about coal. Out. For a split second, the space around Werner tears in half, as though the last molecules of oxygen have been ripped out of it. Then shards of stone and wood and metal streaked past, ringing against his helmet, sizzling into the wall behind them, and Volkheimer's barricade collapses, and everywhere in the darkness things scuttle and slide, and he cannot find any air to breathe. But the detonation creates some tectonic shift in the building's rubble, and there is a snap followed by multiple cascades in the darkness. When Werner stops coughing and pushes the debris off his chest, he finds Volkheimer staring up at a single sheared hole of purple light. Sky. Night sky. A shaft of starlight slices through the dust and drops along the edges of a mound of rubble to the floor. For a moment, Werner inhales it. Then Volkheimer urges him back and climbs halfway up the ruined staircase and begins wailing away at the edges of the hole with a piece of rebar. The iron clangs and his hands lacerate, and his six-day beard glows white with dust. But Werner can see that Volkheimer makes quick progress. The sliver of light becomes a violet wedge, wider across than two of Werner's hands. With one more blow, Volkheimer manages to pulverize a big slab of debris, much of it crashing onto his helmet and shoulders, and then it is simply a matter of scrabbling and climbing. He squeezes his upper body through the hole, his shoulders scraping on the edges, his jacket tearing, hips twisting, and then he's through. He reaches down for Werner, his canvas duffel, and the rifle, and pulls them all up. They kneel atop what was once an alley. Starlight hangs over everything. No moon, Werner can see. Volkheimer turns his bleeding palms up as though to catch the air, to let it seep into his skin like rainwater. Only two walls of the hotel stand, joined at the corner, bits of plaster attached to the inner wall. Beyond it, houses display their interiors to the night. The rampart behind the hotel remains, though many of its embrasures along the top have been shattered. The sea presents a barely audible wash on the other side. Everything else is rubble and silence. Starlight rains onto every crenellation. How many men decompose in the piles of stone before them? 9, maybe more. They made for the lee of the ramparts, both of them staggering like drunks. When they reach the wall, Volkheimer blinks down at Werner, then out at the night. His face so dusted white, he looks like a colossus made of powder. 5 blocks to the south, is the girl still playing her recording? Volkheimer says, "Take the rifle, go." "And you?" "Food." Werner rubs his eyes against the glory of the starlight. He feels no hunger, as if he has rid himself forever of the nuisance of eating. "But will we?" "Go," says Volkheimer again. Werner looks at him a last time, his torn jacket and shovel jaw, the tenderness of his big hands. What you could be. Did he know all along? Werner moves from cover to cover, canvas bag in his left hand, rifle in his right. 5 rounds left. In his mind, he hears the girl whisper, "He is here. He will kill me." West, down a canyon of rubble, scrambling over bricks and wires and pieces of roof slates, many of them still hot, the streets apparently abandoned, though what eyes might track him from behind shattered windows, German or French or American or British, he cannot say. Possibly the crosshairs of a sniper center on him this very second. Here is a single platform shoe. Here a fretwork wooden chef on his back, holding a board on which remains chalk today's soup. Here great tangled coils of barbed wire. Everywhere the reek of corpses. Crouching in the lee of what was a tourist gift shop, a few souvenir plates in their racks, each with a different name printed on the rim and arranged alphabetically. Werner locates himself in the city. Coiffure d'Armes across the street. A bank with no windows. A dead horse attached to its cart. Here and there an intact building stands without its window glass. The filigreed trails of smoke grown up from its windows like the shadows of ivy that have been ripped away. What light shines at night? He never knew. Day will blind him. Werner turns right on what he believes is the Rue d'Estrée. Number 4 on the Rue Vaubarais still stands. Every window on its facade has been broken, but the walls are hardly scorched. 2 of its wooden flower boxes hang on.
He is right below me.
They said what he needed was certainty, purpose, clarity. That pigeon-chested commandant Bastien, with his grandmother's walk, he said they would strip the hesitation out of him.
We are a volley of bullets. We are cannonballs. We are the tip of the sword.
Who is the weakest? Wardrobe. Von Rumpel wobbles before the mighty cabinet, peers into the old clothes inside. Waistcoats, striped trousers, moth-chewed chambray shirts with tall collars and comically long sleeves. Boys' clothes, decades old. What is this room? The big mirrors on the wardrobe doors are spotted black with age, and old leather boots stand beneath a little desk, and a whisk broom hangs from a peg. On the desk stands a photograph of a boy in breeches on a beach at dusk. Beyond the broken window hangs a windless night, ashes swirling in the starlight. The voice filtering through the ceiling repeats itself.
The brain is locked in total darkness, of course, children, and yet the world it constructs.
Lowering in pitch and warping as the batteries die, the lesson slowing as though the young man is exhausted, and then it stops. Heart galloping, head failing, candle in one hand, pistol in the other, Von Rumpel turns again to the wardrobe. Big enough to climb inside. How did such a monstrous thing ever get up to the 6th floor? He brings the candle closer and sees in the shadows of the hanging shirts what he missed on previous inspections. Trails through the dust, made by fingers or knees or both. With the barrel of his pistol, he nudges the clothes. How deep does it go? He leans all the way inside, and as he does, he hears a chime, twin bells tinkling above and below. The sound makes him jerk backward, and he knocks his head on the top of the wardrobe, and the candle falls, and Von Rumpel lands on his back. He watches the candle roll, its flame pointing up. Why? What curious principle demands that a candle flame taper always toward the sky? 5 days in this house and no diamond. The last German-controlled port in Brittany nearly lost, the Atlantic Wall with it. Already he has lived beyond the deadline the doctor predicted, and now the tolling of the 2 tiny bells. This is how death comes? The candle rolls gently toward the window, toward the curtains. Downstairs the door of the house creaks open. Someone steps inside. Comrades. Shattered crockery litters the foyer, impossible to be noiseless as he enters. A kitchen full of debris waits down a corridor, hallway deep with drifts of ash, chair overturned, staircase ahead. Unless she has moved in the past few minutes, she will be high in the house, close to the transmitter. Rifle in both hands, bag over his shoulder, Werner starts up. At each landing, a rushing blackness throws off his vision. Spots open and close at his feet. Books have been thrown down the stairwell, along with papers, cords, bottles, and what might be pieces of antique dollhouses. 2nd floor, 3rd, 4th, 5th, all the same state. He has no sense of how much noise he makes or whether it matters. On the 6th floor, the stairs appear to end. 3 half-open doors frame the landing, one to the left, one ahead, one to the right. He goes to his right, rifle up. He expects the flash of gun barrels, the jaws of a demon swinging open. Instead, a broken window illuminates a gray-backed bed. A girl's dress hangs in an armoire. Hundreds of tiny things, pebbles, line the baseboards. 2 buckets stand in a corner, half full of what might be water. Is he too late? He props Volkheimer's rifle against the bed and raises a bucket and drinks once, twice. Out the window, far beyond the neighboring block, beyond the ramparts, The single light of a boat appears and disappears as it rises and falls on distant swells. A voice behind him says, "Ah!" Werner turns. In front of him totters a German officer in field dress, the five bars and three diamonds of a sergeant major. Pale and bruised, lean to the point of infirmity, he shambles toward the bed. The right side of his throat spills weirdly above the tightness of his collar.
"I do not comprehend," he says, "mixing morphine with Beaujolais."
A vein on the side of the man's forehead throbs lightly.
"I saw you," says Werner, "in front of the bakery with a newspaper." "And you, little private, I saw you."
In his smile, Werner recognizes an assumption that they are kindred, comrades, accomplices, that each has come to this house seeking the same thing. Behind the sergeant major, across the hall, impossibly, flames. A curtain in the room directly across the landing has caught fire. Already flames are licking the ceiling. The sergeant major loops one finger under his collar and pulls against its tightness. His face gaunt and his teeth maniacal, he sits on the bed. Starlight winks off the barrel of his pistol. At the foot of the bed, Werner can just make out a low table upon which scaled-down wooden houses crowd together to form a city. Is it Saint Malo? His eyes flash from the model to the flames across the hall to Volkheimer's rifle leaning against the bed. The officer bends forward and looms over the miniature city like some tormented gargoyle. Tendrils of black smoke have begun to snake into the hall.
"The curtain, sir, it's on fire." "The ceasefire is scheduled for noon, or so they say," Von Rumpel says in an empty voice. "No need to rush. Plenty of time."
He jogs the fingers of one hand down a miniature street.
"We want the same thing, you and I, private. But only one of us can have it, and only I know where it is, which presents a problem for you. Is it here, or here, or here, or here?"
He rubs his hands together, then lies back on the bed. He points his pistol at the ceiling.
"Is it up there?"
In the room beyond the landing, the burning curtain sloughs off its rod. Maybe it will go out, thinks Werner. Maybe it will go out on its own. Werner thinks about the men and the sunflowers and 100 others, each laid dead in his hut or truck or bunker, wearing the look of someone who has caught the tune of a familiar song. A crease between the eyes, a slackness to the mouth, a look that said, "So soon?" But doesn't it play for everybody too soon? Firelight plays across the hall. Still on his back, the sergeant major takes the pistol in both hands and opens and closes the breech.
"Drink some more," he says, and gestures toward the bucket in Werner's hands. "I can see how thirsty you are. I didn't pee in it, I promise."
Werner sets down the bucket. The sergeant major sits up and tilts his head back and forth as though working out kinks in his neck. Then he aims his gun at Werner's chest. From down the hall in the direction of the burning curtain comes a muted clattering, something bouncing down a ladder and striking the floor, and the sergeant major's attention swings toward the noise, and the barrel of his gun dips. Werner lunges for Volkheimer's rifle. All your life you wait, and then it finally comes, and are you ready? The simultaneity of instants. The brick claps onto the floor. The voices stop. She can hear a scuffle, and then the shot comes like a breach of crimson light, the eruption of Krakatoa, the house briefly riven in two. Marie-Laura half slides, half falls down the ladder and presses her ear against the false back of the wardrobe. Footsteps hurry across the landing and enter Henri's room. There is a splash and a hiss, and she smells smoke and steam. Now the footsteps become hesitant. They are different from the sergeant major's, lighter, stepping, stopping, opening the doors of the wardrobe, thinking, figuring it out. She can hear a light, brushing sound as he runs his fingers along the back of the wardrobe. She tightens her grip on the handle of the knife. 3 blocks to the east, Frank Volkheimer blinks as he sits in a devastated apartment on the corner of the Rue des Lauriers and the Rue Thévenard, eating from a tin of sweet yams with his fingers. Across the river mouth, beneath 4 feet of concrete, an aide holds open the garrison commander's jacket as the colonel swings one arm through a sleeve, then the other. At precisely the same moment, a 19-year-old American scout climbing the hillside toward the pillboxes stops and turns and reaches an arm down for the soldier behind him, while with his cheekbone pressed to a granite paver at the Fort National, Etienne Leblanc decides that if he and Marie Laura live through this, whatever happens, he will let her pick a place on the equator, and they will go, book a ticket, ride a ship, fly an airplane until they stand together in a rainforest surrounded by flowers they've never smelled, listening to birds they've never heard. 300 miles away from Fort National, Reinhold von Rumpel's wife wakes her daughters to go to Mass and contemplates the good looks of her neighbor who has returned from the war without one of his feet. Not all that far from her, Jutta Fenning sleeps in the ultramarine shadows of the girls' dormitory and dreams of light thickening and settling across a field like snow. And not all that far from Jutta, the Führer raises a glass of warm, but never boiled, milk to his lips, a slice of Oldenburg black bread on his plate, and a whole apple beside it, his daily breakfast. While in a ravine outside Kiev, 2 inmates rub their hands in sand because they have become slippery, and then they take up the stretcher again while a Sonderkommando stirs the fire below them with a steel pole. A wagtail flits from flagstone to flagstone in a courtyard in Berlin, searching for snails to eat. At the Napola school in Schopforta, 119 12 and 13-year-olds wait in a queue behind a truck to be handed 30-pound anti-tack landmines, boys who, in almost exactly 1 year, marooned amid the Russian advance, the entire school, cut off like an island, will be given a box of the Reich's last bitter chocolate and Wehrmacht helmets salvaged from dead soldiers, and then this final harvest of the nation's youth will rush out with the chocolate melting in their guts and overlarge helmets bobbling on their shorn heads and 60 Panzerfaust rocket launchers in their hands in a last spasm of futility to defend a bridge that no longer requires defending, while T-34 tanks from the White Russian Army come clicking and rumbling toward them to destroy them all, every last child. Drawn in some mallow, and there is a twitch on the other side of the wardrobe. Werner hears Marie Laura inhale. Marie Laura hears Werner scrape 3 fingernails across the wood, a sound not unlike the sound of a record coursing beneath the surface of a needle. Their faces and arms reach apart. He says, "Es-tu là?" "Are you there?" He is a ghost. He is from some other world. He is Papa, Madame Manek, Etienne. He is everyone who has left her finally coming back. Through the panel he calls, "I am not killing you. I am hearing you. On radio is why I come." He pauses, fumbling to translate. "The song, Light of the Moon." She almost smiles. We all come into existence as a single cell, smaller than a speck of dust, much smaller. Divide, multiply, add and subtract. Matter changes hands. Atoms flow in and out. Molecules pivot. Proteins stitch together. Mitochondria send out their oxidative dictates. We begin as a microscopic electrical swarm. The lungs, the brain, the heart. 40 weeks later, 6 trillion cells get crushed in the vise of our mother's birth canal, and we howl. Then the world starts in on us. Marie Laura slides open the wardrobe. Werner takes her hand and helps her out. Her feet find the floor of her grandfather's room.
Mais souliers, she says, I have not been able to find my shoes.
Second can. The girl sits very still in the corner and wraps her coat around her knees, the way she tucks her ankles up against her bottom, the way her fingers flutter through the space around her, each a thing he hopes never to forget. Guns boom to the east, the citadel being bombarded again, the citadel bombarding back. Exhaustion breaks over him. In French, he says, Je vais bien à Wolfenruhe, stopping in the fighting at noon, so people can get out of the city. I can get you out.
And you know this is true?
No, he says, I do not know it is true.
Quiet now. He examines his trousers, his dusty coat. The uniform makes him an accomplice in everything this girl hates.
There is water, he says, and crosses to the other sixth-floor room and does not look at Von Rumpel's body in her bed and retrieves the second bucket.
Her whole head disappears inside its mouth, and her stick-like arms hug its side as she gulps.
He says, You are very brave.
She lowers the bucket.
What is your name?
He tells her. She says,
When I lost my sight, Werner, people said I was brave. When my father left, people said I was brave. But it is not bravery. I have no choice. I wake up and live my life. Don't you do the same?
He says, Not in years, but today. Today maybe I did.
Her glasses are gone, and her pupils look like they are full of milk, but strangely they do not unnerve him. He remembers a phrase of Frau Elena's Belle Lade, beautiful, ugly.
What day is it?
He looks around. Scorched curtains and soot fanned across the ceiling and cardboard peeling off the window and the very first pale light of pre-dawn leaking through.
I don't know. It's morning.
A shell screams over the house, he thinks. I only want to sit here with her for 1,000 hours. But the shell detonates somewhere, and the house creaks, and Werner says,
There was a man who used that transmitter you have, who broadcast lessons about science. When I was a boy, I used to listen to them with my sister.
That was the voice of my grandfather. You heard him.
Many times. We loved them.
The window glows. The slow, sandy light of dawn permeates the room. Everything transient and aching, everything tentative. To be here in this room, high in this house, out of the cellar, with her, it is like medicine.
I could eat bacon, she says.
What?
I could eat a whole pig,
he smiles. I could eat a whole cow.
The woman who used to live here, the housekeeper, she made the most wonderful omelets in the world.
When I was little, he says, or hopes he says, we used to pick berries by the Ruhr, my sister and me. We'd find berries as big as our thumbs.
The girl crawls into the wardrobe and climbs a ladder and comes back down clutching a dented tin can.
Can you see what this is?
There's no label.
I didn't think there was.
Is it food?
Let's open it and find out.
With one stroke from the brick, he punctures the can with the tip of the knife. Immediately he can smell it. The perfume is so sweet, so outrageously sweet, that he nearly faints. What is the word?
Pêches? Les pêches?
The girl leans forward. The freckles seem to bloom across her cheeks as she inhales.
We will share, she says, for what you did.
He hammers the knife in a second time, saws away at the metal, and bends up the lid.
Careful, he says, and passes it to her. She dips in 2 fingers, digs up a wet, soft, slippery thing.
Then he does the same. That first peach slithers down his throat like rapture, a sunrise in his mouth. They eat. They drink the syrup. They run their fingers around the inside of the can. Birds of America. What wonders in this house! She shows him the transmitter in the attic. its double battery, its old-fashioned electrophone, the hand-machined antenna that can be raised and lowered along the chimney by an ingenious system of levers, even a phonograph record that she says contains her grandfather's voice, lessons in science for children, and the books. The lower floors are blanketed with them. Becquerel, Lavoisier, Fischer, a lifetime of reading. What would it be like to spend 10 years in this tall, narrow house, shuttered from the world, studying its secrets and reading its volumes and looking at this girl? "Do you think," he asked, "that Captain Nemo survived the whirlpool?" Marie-Laure sits on the fifth-floor landing in her oversized coat, as though waiting for a train. "Non," she says. "Yes, I don't know. I suppose that is the point, no? To make us wander?" She cocks her head. "He was a madman, and yet I didn't want him to die." In the corner of her great-uncle's study, amid a tumult of books, he finds a copy of Birds of America, a reprint, not nearly as large as the one he saw in Friedrich's living room, but dazzling nonetheless. 435 engravings. He carries it out to the landing. "Has your uncle showed you this?"
"What is it?"
"Birds. Bird after bird after bird." Outside, shells fly back and forth.
"We must get lower in the house," she says, but for a moment they do not move.
California partridge, common gannet, frigate pelican. Werner can still see Friedrich kneeling at his window, nose to the glass, little gray bird hopping about in the boughs.
"Doesn't look like much, does it? Could I keep a page from this?" "Why not? We will leave soon, no? When it is safe?"
"At noon."
"How will we know when it is time?"
"When they stop shooting." Airplanes come, dozens and dozens of them. Werner shivers uncontrollably. Marie-Laure leads him to the first floor, where ash and soot lie a half-inch deep over everything, and he pushes capsized furniture out of the way and hauls open the cellar door, and they climb down. Somewhere above, 30 bombers let fly their payloads, and Werner and Marie-Laure feel the bedrock shake, hear the detonations across the river. Could he, by some miracle, keep this going? Could they hide here until the war ends, until the armies finish marching back and forth above their heads, until all they have to do is push open the door and shift some stones aside, and the house has become a ruin beside the sea, until he can hold her fingers in his palms and lead her out into the sunshine? He would walk anywhere to make it happen, bear anything. In a year or three or 10, France and Germany would not mean what they mean now. They would leave the house and walk to a tourist restaurant and order a simple meal together and eat it in silence, the comfortable kind of silence lovers are supposed to share.
"Do you know," Marie-Laure asks in a gentle voice, "why he was here, that man upstairs?"
"Because of the radio?" Even as he says it, he wonders.
"Maybe," she says, "maybe that's why."
In another minute, they're asleep. Ceasefire. Gritty summer light spills through the open trap door into the cellar. It might already be afternoon. No guns firing. For a few heartbeats, Werner watches her sleep. Then they hurry. He cannot find the shoes she asked for, but he finds a pair of men's loafers in a closet and helps her put them on. Over his uniform, he pulls on some of Etienne's tweed trousers, along with a shirt whose sleeves are too long. If they run into Germans, he will speak only French, saying he is helping her leave the city. If they run into Americans, he will say he is deserting.
"There will be a collection point," he says. "Somewhere they're gathering refugees."
Though he's not sure he says it correctly, he finds a white pillowcase in an upturned cabinet and folds it into her coat pocket.
"When it comes time, hold this as high as you can."
"I will try, and my cane."
"Here."
In the foyer, they hesitate, neither sure what waits on the other side of the door. He remembers the overheated dance hall from the entrance exams 4 years before, ladder bolted to the wall, crimson flag with its white circle and black cross below. You step forward, you jump. Outside, mountains of rubble hunker everywhere. Chimneys stand with their bricks raw to the light. Smoke troweled across the sky. He knows that the shells have been coming from the east, that 6 days ago the Americans were almost to Parame, so he moves Marie-Laure in that direction. Any moment, they will be seen by either Americans or his own army and made to do something. Work, join, confess, die. From somewhere comes the sound of fire, the sound of dried roses being crumpled in a fist. No other sounds, no motors, no airplanes, no distant pop of gunfire or howling of wounded men or yapping of dogs. He takes her hand to help her over the piles. No shells fall, and no rifles crack, and the light is soft and shot through with ash. Jutta, he thinks, I've finally listened. For 2 blocks they see nobody. Maybe Volkheimer is eating. This is what Werner would like to imagine. Gigantic Volkheimer eating by himself at a little table with a view of the sea. It's so quiet. Her voice, like a bright, clear window of sky. Her face, a field of freckles. He thinks, I don't want to let you go.
Are they watching us?
I don't know. I don't think so. A block ahead, he sees movement. 3 women carrying bundles. Marie-Laure pulls at his sleeve.
What is this cross street?
The Rue de Laurier. Come, she says, and walks with her cane tapping back and forth in her right hand. They turn right and left, past a walnut tree like a giant charred toothpick jammed into the ground, past 2 crows picking at something unidentifiable, until they reach the base of the ramparts. Airborne creepers of ivy hang from an archway over a narrow valley. Far to his right, Werner can see a woman in blue taffeta drag a great overstuffed suitcase over a curbstone. A boy in pants meant for a younger child follows, beret thrown back on his head, some kind of shiny jacket on.
There are civilians leaving, mademoiselle. Shall I call to them? I need only a moment.
She leads him deeper down the alley. Sweet, unfettered ocean air pours through a gap in the wall he cannot see. The air throbs with it. At the end of the alley, they reach a narrow gate. She reaches inside her coat and produces a key.
Is the tide high?
He can just see through the gate into a low space, bounded by a grate on the far side.
There is water down there. We have to hurry.
But she is already passing through the gate and descending into the grotto in her big shoes. Moving with confidence, running her fingers along the walls as though they were old friends she thought she might never meet again. The tide pushes a low riffle through the pool, and it washes over her shins and dampens the hem of her dress. From her coat, she takes some small wooden thing and sets it in the water. She speaks lightly, her voice echoing.
You need to tell me, is it in the ocean? It must be in the ocean.
It is in. We must go, mademoiselle.
Are you certain it's in the water?
Yes. We've come to the end of the book hour in today's reading of All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr. Preceding program was a production of Sight into Sound Radio.